It is Wednesday, September 14th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington. Coming up, the United States moves to restore trade benefits to Myanmar. New York State is investigating the Trump Foundation regarding its charitable contributions.
Trump had figured out a way to take the donations and then make contributions to other charities in his name, coming from his foundation.
And lifestyle changes could reverse early signs of dementia. It's all ahead. U.S. President Barack Obama is welcoming Myanmar's Aung San Suu Kyi to the White House Wednesday, and VOA White House correspondent Cindy Sain joins us now. Cindy, you know, the U.S. lifting sanctions on Myanmar, is that the primary focus of the talks today? It should be remembered that those sanctions were imposed under the earlier military government.
Yes, that's right, Sarah, and this is a great time for us to be talking because we have some breaking news. The president just said that he is prepared to lift broader economic sanctions on Myanmar, and he just spoke with their de facto leader, Aung San Suu Kyi, and she also said that the time has come now to lift all economic sanctions against the country, and that unity needs prosperity. And the president encouraged Americans to travel to Burma, saying it's a beautiful country with wonderful people and a budding tourism industry that would welcome them. So it looks like it's been a most productive meeting here.
But there are also human rights concerns, particularly in regard to minorities in Myanmar. How do those concerns factor in these talks?
Well, they were addressed. The president brought them up, and Aung San Suu Kyi also said that these were concerns in a very poor state where that should not be ignored. And she is vowing to continue to work on that and asking the U.S. and other countries as partners to work with them. But she is saying that now the time has come to lift sanctions. And a reporter asked the president, you know, when, because the president said the U.S. is prepared to lift sanctions, when that would happen, and the president said soon. He repeated soon several times. So the Congress, of course, will also have a role in this, and Aung San Suu Kyi met with congressional leaders at Vice President Biden's residence.
Mm-hmm. Well, Aung San Suu Kyi, she's not Myanmar's president. She holds titles of state counselor and foreign minister, but this meeting with Mr. Obama seems to reinforce her status as the country's really actual leader.
Yes, that's right. That's right. She's not president, but she it's shown very clearly that she is viewed here, at least, as a civilian leader of the country. And her remarks, she said that she, you know, wants the military to be respected and beloved in her country, but the military should have no place in politics, saying that there's still much to be done in the way of democratic reforms in her country.
Thanks very much, Cindy. That's Cindy Sain at the White House. Joining me here in the studio is our social media editor, Michael Lippin, with a look at what's trending. So, Michael, what's going on?
Hi, Sarah. Well, one of today's top Twitter trends in the United States is about the latest leak of emails related to the Democratic Party and its presidential nominee, Hillary Clinton. The hashtag that people are using is #DNCLeak. And the leak that is getting the most attention today is from a hacker group called DC Leaks. Now, that group published a batch of documents on Tuesday, allegedly containing email conversations about Clinton involving one of her predecessors as Secretary of State, Colin Powell, and Powell's business partner, Jeffrey Leeds, who has been a big donor to the Democratic Party. Now, those emails between Powell and Leeds were later posted on Twitter by online news site The Intercept. Intercept reporter Li Fang, who is at LH Fang, sent out this tweet today. Colin Powell and mega Democratic donor Jeffrey Leeds chat about how much the Clintons hate Obama, and that is via the newly leaked emails. Now, in the emails, Leeds apparently claims that that Hillary Clinton hates Obama for beating her in the race to be the Democratic presidential nominee in 2008. I should add that we have not yet seen a confirmation of that email conversation from either of the two men involved. And of course, we can't verify that Clinton really hates Obama. After all, she did agree to serve as his Secretary of State.
Well, indeed. And how are people reacting to that on Twitter?
Well, here's a tweet that I saw from a U.S. Republican House member, Representative Stephen Smith. He asked this question on Twitter today. If Hillary really hates Obama, yet acted this way with him, and by this way, he posted a picture showing Obama and Hillary being very cozy, hugging each other at the Democratic convention just a month ago, then what does that indicate about everything else Hillary said at the DNC? So he's implying that perhaps Hillary Clinton wasn't being sincere in her affection for Obama at the DNC. Another Twitter user whose handle is at Steph93065 said, I finally found something that I am with her about. I hate Obama too. And she's playing on that slogan of Hillary Clinton's, hashtag I am with her. But I should also add that there's plenty of skepticism on Twitter that Hillary Clinton ever expressed such sentiments about Obama. In fact, this is coming from a third party, so we'll have to see.
Okay, thanks very much, Michael. That's Michael Lippin. India. Here are some of the top stories that are trending. India promises $1 billion in aid during the Afghan president's visit. The president of the European Union calls for a common military force ahead of a key summit. With Syria ceasefire holding, aid deliveries await approval from President Assad. And President Obama wants a large refugee intake increased in 2017. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on the voanews.com website. This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
Entomologists at Utah State University have confirmed the discovery of a rare species of bee that builds its nest in hard sandstone rather than in softer soils and environments. A new study outlining the findings also examines why these little bees put in so much effort to dig through rocks to create their home structures. This species of bees make their homes in the harsh desert environment of the U.S. Southwest. Michael Orr, lead author of the study, says that sandstone is more durable than most other nesting options and that these tough, elevated shelters do protect the bees from erosion and sudden flash floods. He also points out that since sandstone doesn't have as much organic material as regular soil, parasite buildup over the years is naturally controlled, preventing the growth of life-threatening microbes inside the bees' living quarters. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Sarah Williams. Coming up, the United States and Israel prepare to sign a military aid package. The state of New York has opened an investigation into the family foundation of Republican presidential candidate Donald Trump. Now, this follows published reports claiming that he's not donated any money to the charity since 2008 and that he once used the foundation's money to buy a life-sized portrait of himself. I'm joined now by VOA's Ken Brademeyer. So, Ken, what is known about this foundation, the charitable arm of this foundation?
Donald Trump and, as it turns out, Hillary Clinton and her husband, both have operated foundations, family foundations, charitable foundations, if you will. But they both are playing a big role in the 2016 campaign. And now we have the New York State Attorney General, Eric Schneiderman, saying that he's looking into whether there have been any improprieties in the way Trump has operated his foundation.
There also have been some questions in the past about this Trump University, a business, I believe, run by the Trump organization.
There certainly are accusations there, too, that the students who bought these real estate courses, paying thousands of dollars in tuition, got little for their money. Trump has rejected those accusations, but there are a number of lawsuits that are pending and likely will be unresolved at the time of the November 8 election.
Well, now, looking at the Trump Foundation and the charity, what is known about, you know, who contributed, if not Trump, who did contribute to these charities?
He sought big money donors. And the Washington Post, in looking at these transactions over the years, found that Trump had figured out a way to take the donations and then make contributions to other charities in his name, coming from his foundation.
And what about that life-size photo or whatever?
Well, it was a painting. The Post reported that Trump spent $20,000 that had been set aside for charitable donations, and it was nearly 2 meters tall. It became the subject yesterday. President Obama, in another endorsement speech for Hillary Clinton, made fun of it and joked that, at least Trump didn't go for the 10-foot version.
Well, in addition, there have been leaking of some emails from former Secretary of State Colin Powell, in which he offered fairly negative views of Mr. Trump.
Well, he called him a national disgrace and an international pariah. There's obviously no love lost there. And while Powell served under Republican presidents, he has not endorsed Trump for president. I must say he also didn't like how Hillary Clinton has tried to link his email usage when he was the Secretary of State to what she did when she served more recently. So Colin Powell offered some somewhat negative views of both of them in these emails that were leaked in the last day.
All right. Thanks very much, Ken. That's VOA's Ken Bredemeyer. The United States and Israel Wednesday will sign an unprecedented military aid package totaling nearly $40 billion over the next 10 years. Israel says it constitutes the single largest pledge of assistance in U.S. history. It surpasses the annual payment under the current agreement, which expires in 2018. The Memorandum of Understanding includes annual funding for Israeli missile defense and provides the Jewish state with $3.8 billion each year through 2028. Regional analyst Michael Fishbach of Randolph-Macon College in Virginia tells International Edition's Victor Beatty that since Israel's founding in 1948, it's estimated that the U.S., as of 2014, has provided Israel with $234 billion in aid adjusted for inflation. Fishbach says that dwarfs financial support to any other country, and it is the one issue that unites almost all politicians in the U.S.
It is another very clear demonstration of the unanimity of voices in the American political structure, Republican, Democrat, in the unanimity of support for the idea that in a Middle East that is seen as fraught with danger, that this is by far and away a valuable investment, so the logic goes, in preserving American interests. It's not about the power of the so-called Israeli lobby. It's a clear representation that despite tensions between President Obama and Prime Minister of Israel Netanyahu, that this wider, deeper concern for protecting American interests by protecting Israel's security is paramount. And I think that's the real message here.
Interesting, it comes at a time when the U.S. has been sharply critical of Israel's settlement policy.
That underscores several things. Certainly from the perspective of the American foreign policy elite, from Congress, from the President, it is again more proof that despite squabbling and bickering and even some sharp words, that the end of the day is the United States is going to back Israel 110%.
The new package, for the first time, incorporates funds for Israeli missile defense. This comes in the wake of the international Iran nuclear deal.
Well, this was part of the political drama behind this, is that in addition to the other things they disagreed on, Prime Minister Netanyahu basically held up many of the negotiations. They had originally wanted something more along the line of $50 billion over 10 years. The fact of his displeasure over the fact that the Iran nuclear deal was signed was both fueling his intransigence, but interestingly, on the other hand, it also put pressure on President Obama to make sure that, especially because of the Iran nuclear deal, that he could leave his presidency having demonstrated his bona fides as far as maintaining support to Israel. A lot of the missile defense, by the way, is particularly focused on shorter-range missiles that are in the hands of Hezbollah in Lebanon.
That is Michael Fishbach of Randolph-Macon College. The agreement, which must receive congressional approval, is supposed to include language that limits Israel's ability to ask for more money, as it has done in the past. This is VOA.
Democracy in action. That's what the U.S. presidential election is all about. Who's going to be the new president of the United States come November 8th? Tune in to VOA's coverage of the 2016 presidential election. Reports, expert analysis, and more. Professional, up-to-the-minute coverage that can't be found anywhere else. Right here on VOA.
Hi, my name's Larry London. Welcome to Border Crossings, your request and dedication program here at the Voice of America. 1500 Universal, Monday through Friday, we're there for an hour playing your favorite music. You can send an email in and request your favorite songs by your favorite artists. You can also phone in as well. We have great contests and surprise guests from time to time. Border Crossings, every single day during the week at 1500 Universal, here on the Voice of America.
This is International Edition. The Alzheimer's Association calls Alzheimer's the only disease among the top 10 causes of death in America that cannot be prevented, cured, or even slowed. This gloomy outlook means many people avoid screening tests for dementia. Now a U.S. scientist has documented reversal of early Alzheimer's in a small case study, largely through lifestyle interventions. Some activists with a high genetic risk for Alzheimer's say the study bolsters their efforts to speak openly about ways to foster healthy brains. From Boulder, Colorado, Shelley Schwendler reports.
The two dozen friends gathered for a late summer picnic in Boulder, Colorado, are here for salad, yoga stretches, and support. They've teamed up to reduce their risk for a brain-destroying disease known as Alzheimer's.
We all found out that we carried one or two copies of the APOE4 gene, which puts us at higher risk for Alzheimer's.
Susan, who offers only her first name, says her father died from Alzheimer's. During his decline, doctors had little to offer except a memory-boosting drug called Aricept.
It was just more or less, well, we could try Aricept, but it won't work for very long. And there's a fatalistic attitude with some doctors that once you have it, there's nothing you can do, and you just sort of have to get your affairs in order and expect that you're going to the nursing home next.
Susan discovered she has the APOE4 genetic trait 4 years ago. Determined not to do nothing, she went online and sought other people with her genotype.
A bunch of us banded together and decided to see, can we hack our own health?
One of those hackers is Julie G. Before teaming up with Susan, Julie G had been anxiously monitoring her increasing senior moments at the not-so-senior age of 49. Then she learned that she has the APOE4 genetic trait.
When I put the symptoms I was having together with my very high risk of developing Alzheimer's disease, I was pretty terrified.
Her fear turned to courage as she helped build an online community named APOE4.info. The health hackers dug into the conflicting studies about healthy brains, then focused in on leafy greens, healthy fats, exercise, and more.
It's been a very exciting journey. My cognition is very much improved now.
Her group's approach is validated by the work of Dale Bredesen of the Buck Institute for Research on Aging. He studies how combining lifestyle changes with other interventions can reverse cognitive decline and has conferred with the APOE4.info group for 2 years. In June, Bredesen added to their optimism when he documented memory improvements for even early Alzheimer's.
This is the first time in history that there's been reversal of cognitive decline in early Alzheimer's disease. And we now have also the first objective improvements, volumetric changes on MRI, cognitive changes with neuropsychological quantitative testing. This is the first time that that's been done.
Bredesen says most attempts to prevent dementia fail because they focus on a magic bullet, such as a single drug. That's even though too often, cognitive decline is caused by several problems that interfere with a healthy brain. Bredesen joined the APOE4.info group for its August meeting in Boulder. He calls them people who walk the talk by using a variety of synergistic ways to help the brain. While he recommends personalizing those ways, his interventions often include rigorous exercise, a low-carb ketogenic diet, tests that uncover hidden chronic infections, supplements to deal with nutrition imbalances, and more.
It turns out when you actually look at the molecular mechanistics driving the underlying problem, the cognitive decline that ultimately leads to Alzheimer's, guess what? You see a component that is stress-related. You see a component that's sleep-related.
All this gives members of the APOE4.info group more confidence that a genetic risk does not have to be a destiny.
I can hopefully prevent it, but if not, at least put it off for decades.
Bredesen adds that the earlier people find out that they might be at risk for dementia, the easier it is to turn things around.
What's happened up until now is that people will say, don't bother to find out your APOE status, because if you find out that you're APOE4 positive, then there will be nothing to do about it. And again, we disagree with that. There's a lot that can be done with it today.
Bredesen plans clinical studies to refine his approach for reversing cognitive decline. The Alzheimer's Association calls his work a promising possibility that may help the United States develop national policies to prevent or effectively treat Alzheimer's disease by the year 2025. For VOA News, I'm Shelley Schlender in Boulder.
And that is our show. Please remember to visit our website at voanews.com. I'm Sarah Williams. Thanks so much for joining us.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
18 months ago, a conflict between Yemen's elected Sunni government and the Houthi opposition, allied with elements loyal to the country's former president, Ali Abdullah Saleh, escalated into a civil war. Subsequently, at the request of the elected Yemeni government, a coalition led by Saudi Arabia launched military airstrikes against the Houthi rebels. And, as is usual in armed conflict, it is the civilian population that suffers the most. Since the conflict broke out in March of last year, some 6,500 people have been killed, about half of them civilians. At the same time, more than 3.1 million Yemenis have been displaced, and more than 80% of the country, or 21 million people, are in need of humanitarian assistance. The numbers don't begin to capture the true depth of the tragedy, but they are nevertheless staggering, said Secretary of State John Kerry at a recent press conference. Food shortages have driven prices up 60% since last March, and they have brought the country to the brink of famine. The Yemeni people need help, and they need it now. But unfortunately, donations are slow in coming, said Secretary of State Kerry. To date, the international response to this crisis has fallen short of filling the gap between the supplies that are available and those that are required. To help fill that gap, the United States, already the largest donor of aid to Yemen, will contribute another $189 million in urgently needed humanitarian assistance. The new funding will go toward additional food and nutritional assistance, emergency health care, hygiene kits, and psychosocial support. It will also help improve access to drinking water and sanitation. Some of the money will also go toward providing food and shelter for Yemeni refugees in the Horn of Africa. We strongly urge other countries in and outside the region to expand their contributions as well, said Secretary of State Kerry. Every party has an obligation to allow the unfettered flow of humanitarian assistance to Yemenis in all parts of the country. That is necessary to save lives and it is also mandated under international law. And it is the right thing to do.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.